for having you.
I'd like to bring the House Committee on Consumer Protection to order. Good afternoon. Monday, April 13th. Today we're going to start out with a work session on the House Bill 3085. Victoria, would you briefly preview the bill for us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 3085 allows amendment of local ordinance regulating manufactured dwelling park closures until January 1st, 2010. If amendment does not reduce the rights of the tenant, we have dash one amendments in front of us, which institute an emergency clause.
Thank you, and I'd like to have John Van Landingham and Representative Chris Edwards come up. Good afternoon, Representative. Welcome to the House Committee on Consumer Protection.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chris Edwards. I'm State Representative in House District 14, West Virginia Junction City. I am here to present you with a couple of things. First, that House Bill 3085 is still a good bill. Second, that the dash one amendments, which only add an emergency clause, make it a better bill and a completely more relevant bill, since it wouldn't work actually without the emergency the emergency clause. So, as you'll remember, this this opens up some statutes that have statewide preemption. It opens up local ordinances to make some changes. And then the statute would be closed back, or that opportunity would be closed back up again on January 1st of 2010. At the last meeting, when I first testified, Representative Gilliam asked if the City of Eugene was in fact going to use or use this. And since I testified previously that they were, I have been informed that I was incorrect, and it is not their intent to be using this this opportunity. But nonetheless, there are a number of communities that, for whom this would make a lot of sense.
Thank you. Any questions of the representative? Mr. Van Landingham, would you like to comment on this bill from the perspective of the people that you've been working with on this?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John Van Landingham, Lane County Legal Aid, and I can report that the Manufactured Housing Landlord-Tenant Coalition supports the bill with the dash one amendment.
Thank you. Representative Winger, question?
Sean, I have been visited by members of that coalition who do not share that opinion, so I guess I'm asking you to be real clear on what it is that you're, who it is you're saying is supporting this.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Wingard, they have not communicated that to me. I heard a rumor in the hallway about 2 minutes ago, but no one in the coalition has communicated that to me. And how the coalition works is that not everybody in the coalition comes to the Capitol. So there are about 50 names on the email list that I communicate with. I keep them updated on where things are, and the main persons that I count on to communicate back to me on behalf of landlords are John Brenneman and Chuck Carpenter for MHCO, since MHCO represents by far the majority of landlords. There are four landlord groups. The second one, that's just park landlords, does not have a lobbyist in the building. In fact, that member is in California, the person who runs that organization. So I can't I can't say more than no one has communicated that to me. Our process has been that if someone disagrees, they have to object, and no one's objected to me.
Follow-up question for the representative.
Follow-up.
Representative Edwards, is it necessary for this to apply to every municipality in the state, or I assume you're bringing this on behalf of Eugene? Can we tailor this bill so that your city can do what they want to do and not necessarily open it up to others?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Winger, I think it is tailored just to those that already have a statute, and unless there's unless I am not understanding the bill properly, it only pertains to those that already have a statute or local ordinance. So, in fact, if this were to pass, somebody that does not have a local ordinance could not put in to place a local ordinance that went above and beyond the state floor for protections currently.
But if I might add, there are six local governments that would be able under this bill as amended to amend their ordinance before January 1, 2010. And one of those six is Wilsonville. So that there are five cities that adopted an ordinance by July 1 of 2007. Eugene, Wilsonville, Bend, Oregon City, Forest Grove, and then Clackamas County. So those six would be eligible to, would have a window in which they could amend their ordinance.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Follow up. I did understand that. I guess I was wondering if we could tailor the bill even more narrowly than it's already tailored. I guess I'm under the assumption, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that you brought the bill on behalf of your constituent municipality, which would be Eugene. I'm wondering if it's possible to tailor the bill to allow you to accomplish what you'd like to do for your constituent municipality and leave it at that.
Chair Holvey, Representative Wengert, I don't know if it's possible to tailor the bill further. In knowing how a lot of these ordinances were crafted, and a lot of them were the local ordinances were crafted in consultation with people that had already crafted the other local ordinances, and I personally think that I am not only bringing this on behalf of my constituents, but also those folks, and personally, I prefer giving them all the opportunity because, as we know, in the statute-making process here in the state capitol, oftentimes it takes two or three sessions to work everything out and get something that's solid and actually works. And they had a short window of opportunity to actually do what they needed to do, and they may have some technical fixes yet to make. So I think that this legislature should give them those local jurisdictions the opportunity to do that, even if they're not in my district.
Representative Barden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to note that I suspect several others, I think, would vehemently object if this bill were more narrowed. It's such to only apply to Eugene, specifically if they were to exempt Clackamas County from that. And I see, I'm very comfortable with the bill as written, and I appreciate your leadership on this, Representative.
Other comments? Thank you, gentlemen, for working to get this issue before us. I agree. It looks like something that we should be able to accomplish. I would entertain a motion at this point.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the adoption of the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 3085.
Representative Riley moves the Dash 1 amendment be adopted into House Bill 3085. Discussion? I sense there may be objection to that amendment. So, Cindy, will you give us a roll call vote, please? And I was going to ask you on reverse alphabetical order this time. Always, you know, throwing something at you.
Representative Winger?
No.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Excused.
Representative Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative Cowan?
Aye.
Representative Barden?
Aye.
Vice Chair Widener?
No.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Holvey?
Chair votes aye. House Bill 3080, or the amendment's adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Riley.
I move House Bill 3085 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended.
Representative Riley moves House Bill 3085 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wingard.
I'm going to be a no vote on this, colleagues, not because I wouldn't be willing to help Representative Edwards out with his municipality, but specifically because it does involve a municipality in my district. On behalf of the taxpayers of Wilsonville, I cannot allow my city to continue to do what they have been doing to them. They passed an ordinance after the last bill, and it was challenged in court, and they fought that, and they have lost in court and continue to appeal it, and have so far spent $1 million of taxpayer funds to defend that ordinance in Wilsonville. Now, full disclosure, I am a taxpayer in Wilsonville, so I'm personally aggrieved by that as well, but on behalf of my fellow taxpayers in Wilsonville, I just cannot, in good conscience, give this city another opportunity to do anything with this ordinance whatsoever. They've had plenty of opportunities to vacate it, and I feel the need to send them a strong message and to try it looks like unsuccessfully today, to protect the taxpayers of Wilsonville from further bleeding.
Thank you, Representative Wingard. I appreciate your sentiment and your comments as well. I'm hopeful that this amendment opportunity for Wilsonville will solve their problems so that they can stop litigating, but time will tell, I suppose. Further comments? Cindy, can we have a roll call vote, please?
Representative Wingard?
Can I vote no twice, or am I only allowed one no? One no.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Excused.
Representative Gilliam?
No.
Representative Cowan?
Aye.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Vice Chair Widener?
No.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Chair votes aye. House Bill 3085, having received the required votes, declared passed to the floor, the due pass recommendation. I will close work session on House. Representative Chris Edwards will carry the bill. I will close work session on House Bill 3085. And we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2366. Victoria, would you give us a brief summary of the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2366 establishes the Residential Structure Lien Assistance Fund to be administered by the Construction Contractors Board, allows capped payouts from the fund to certain lien claimants if owner has paid construction contractor but contractor has not paid claimant, requires paid lien claimant to file satisfaction of lien or judgment, appropriates money from the general fund for 2009 to 2011 biennium, and requires repayment no later than June 30th of 2011. Fund will be continually replenished through a surcharge not to exceed $40 on application for issuance or renewal of residential contractor endorsement, effective on passage with first payment from fund to occur during calendar year 2010.
Thank you. And we have
dash twos.
Dash two amendments.
Mm-hmm.
Before us, on what happened with the dash ones there? We also have dash ones, I believe, yeah. And okay, so if we could have Craig Smith and Mr. Bill Boyd come forward and walk us through the purpose of this bill and the amendment really quickly, or maybe not so quickly. And certainly it was the chair's intent to be considering the dash two amendments, but perhaps you can comment on the main difference between the two amendments for us so the committee is aware of what those are.
Good morning, committee members and Chair Holby. Craig Smith is my name. I'm administrator of the Construction Contractors Board, and we're pleased to be here today to talk about House Bill 2366. Handing out to you today a presentation that's based upon the Dash 2 amendments. And, of course, this is not a CCB bill. This is a committee bill. We hope to be before you with CCB material soon, maybe next month. So we look forward to that. As I understand it, the Dash 1 amendments, the difference between the two, that, just for your information, the problem here is the pay twice lien problem. We're familiar with that. That's the situation where, as an Oregonian, you have some work done. You pay your general contractor in full. The general contractor, for whatever reason, and there are lots of reasons why, but on very rare occasions, the general contractor fails to pay the sub or supplier. When that occurs, the sub and suppliers do have a right to take the homeowner's property and can file a lien. And in the worst case scenario, can foreclose on that lien, and the home can be taken to pay that sub or supplier. And of course, that's a law that is a pretty tough law for consumers to take. Your Construction Contractors Board, and before that, your Builders Board, the predecessor to this organization, brought before you over the last 25 years various solutions. A final solution has not been achieved, and we still have some cases where we have this occur. And of course, whenever it occurs, your constituents, our customers, are outraged. So we keep bringing this back. One day we'll get this fixed. Maybe this is the day. And so there is a -1 amendment and a -2. This solution, at a very high level, provides some additional financial security for homeowners, so that in the event the homeowner had a loss because of a pay twice situation, they can always come to Contractors Board and file a complaint. The problem is, 50% of the time that occurs, the bond, even now that we've raised it, is insufficient to cover those damages. And in many cases, that's because in these very rare cases, it's a result of the contractor going out of business. Usually when the contractor goes out of business in those rare cases, they have filed bankruptcy, and there's a lot of debt, and there are items that don't get paid. And of course, the subs and suppliers, they just want to be paid once. They exercise their lien rights, and of course, then we have this very tough situation. So these solutions that we're talking about today would add an additional financial security, and they would do it through the means of a recovery fund. A recovery fund, quite frankly, is controversial, but it certainly is something that many other states do. Many other contractor boards throughout the country use recovery funds. In some cases, they are the only financial security rather than social or rather than surety bonds. In this case, it would be paired with your current surety bond protection. So in the event the surety bond was insufficient, then this protection would be on top of that. And so there would be a state-managed, if you will, almost insurance for these very limited, small number of complaints. And the difference, of course, between these two, -1 and -2, is where does the money come from to fund this kind of a recovery fund? In the -1 amendments, you would use the agency, the CCB's civil penalties. We issue about $1 million worth of civil penalties a year and collect somewhere between 25% and 35% of those. And so we have quite a bit of money, maybe as much as $500,000 a year. Most of that money goes to the general fund. 80% today does. And in your -1 amendments, it would take a portion of that money to fund this recovery fund. Before you today, I think, is the -2 amendments. And the -2 amendment funding structure is a tax or a surcharge on construction contractors at the time of their licensure, whether it's a new license or a renewal. I should tell you that both funding mechanisms are also not without controversy, okay? Because when you are further taxing all of the contractors, some folks will argue you're having the good contractors pay the bad contractors. And I should tell you that today, if you want to have something close to what your current service level is with your contractors board, we need to raise fees. Raising fees here is hard. We may not get that job done. If we don't get that job done, and we have to look at cutting back with the service levels we provide to contractors and consumers, adding additional surcharges may be a tough row to hoe. So both funding mechanisms are not without controversy. That's the broad view. And with that said, and again, I know I'm talking on both sides, but I think you want that. I think you want the straight scoop here. This is a pretty clever idea, I think, to try to provide some additional consumer protection for some Oregonians that are completely without fault when they end up having to be in this terrible pay-twice situation. That's the very high-level review. And I have Mr. Boyd, who I think I've introduced before, and he's talked to you. He's a lawyer, he's an engineer, and he runs our dispute resolution program, and he would run this program if you so authorized it. And he can talk to you about the details. With your permission then, Chair Hovey, I'll turn it over to Mr. Boyd to talk about the details for 3 to 5 minutes, and then we'll look for questions.
Thank you. I think you did a really good job of laying out the issue before us. So, Mr. Boyd.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, my name is Bill Boyd. I am the manager of the Dispute Resolution Services for the Construction Contractors Board, and as Craig pointed out, I would be administering this program should this bill be enacted. I'm just going to quickly run down through the sections of the bill and tell you what they do. Sections 1 and 2 set up the Residential Structure Lien Assistance Fund, which I'll just talk about as the fund from now on, and that's where the money comes from to reimburse homeowners who have had to pay out a lien. Section 3 establishes the eligibility for reimbursement, and it establishes two criteria. One of them is that you file a lien complaint under our regular statute. We get these all of the time. We get them as both complaints from people who have had a lien filed but it hasn't been adjudicated, and we also get complaints where the lien has been adjudicated or, in fact, they've paid out the money in a settlement with the lien claimant. And that is limited to the pay-twice situation. It doesn't apply to the situation where the homeowner doesn't pay the prime contractor. Mm-hmm. It only applies where the homeowner pays the prime contractor and the prime has failed to pay a material supplier or a subcontractor. The other eligibility possibility is the situation where there is a warranty contract that is part of, and it's usually associated with a home sale. And in that case, say in 3 years down the road, you have discovered that the windows that were installed are leaking, and you call up your general contractor who has sold you the home, and you ask them to, under their warranty obligation, to come back in and fix these leaky windows. And so the contractor comes back in, he orders up, decides that the windows themselves are defective, he orders up some new windows, and he installs them, and then he doesn't pay the window vendor, and the window vendor then files a lien against the homeowner. And so this would cover that situation. It would be only effective 5 years down the road, and it would have to be where there was an actual warranty, contractual warranty obligation. And so then again, it would be the same deal. You file this as a complaint. It wouldn't be one of our regular complaints, but we would process it pretty much the same way. Section 4 provides that the money in the fund can be used to reimburse homeowners. The payments would be made once a year, sometime between January and April, for orders that became final the previous year and for warranty claims that were filed the previous year. If the amount in the fund was insufficient, then the payments would be made out on a pro rata basis. Section 5 provides that after the CCB makes its annual payment, that it would look at its fund, and if it was less than $250,000, it would put a surcharge on contractors' licenses, and only on those contractors that were endorsed or licensed, we say endorsed, for residential work. So it only applied to those people who were had authorized to do residential work. The surcharge could not exceed $40 a year, and it could not reimburse the fund so much that the fund amount in the fund exceeded $500,000. So you could replenish up to $500,000. Section 6 provides sort of an interim surcharge to build up the fund and do that initial building up of the fund. And then the Section 7 provides some a provision for amends one of our statutes to incorporate this warranty work provision. And Section 8 provides for the actual effective date of the Act and what it applies to.
Thank you. Question, Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions, if I may. How long would it take to, do you believe, to build a fund up to its maximum?
I think I'll take that.
Yeah.
Chair Hovey and Vice Chair Riley, it's anticipated, particularly with the surcharge, that we would take the money at the time of licensure, and so it would take 2 years to get the entire amount of eligibility of all of the current licensees as they're on a 2-year cycle.
And
follow up.
And what is your anticipation based on what you know of how much you would need to be paying out every year?
I don't have the fiscal impact. I think that it's going to be around $300,000 to $400,000, but I'm suddenly a little uncertain about that figure.
We'll have to come back and give you that information.
Yeah.
But
one last follow-up.
Follow-up.
So, based on what I just heard, I'm not sure that you would ever catch up, and that concerns me. And I just wondered if you agree with what I just said.
Can I? You know, the numbers that we were able to generate are really guesses. And because we don't know how many liens are filed outside of our system and how many, particularly with this warranty provision, I think that we're going to have some experience with the program. And we may hit it and be great. It may turn out that after we take a look at it, we need to have a bigger surcharge, if that's what you're wanting. Or it may be that we'll just have to live with not providing all of the lien reimbursement. But without, you know, we're kind of shooting in the dark here. And
thank you.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple questions here for you. Because I'm just listening to your scenario, like with the window manufacturer, and then him filing a lien. If the window was bad, he was responsible for it. But I want to go more to the construction side because I have friends there, and I think your estimates are way low because I have two different companies I know of. One that got stuck with about $60,000 owed to him by one home builder that went out of business, and then there was the dig out guys, the lumber guys, and everything. They just did concrete work, and that was from one guy that they got hit off of. So I think you're going to see a much larger number in the economic time that we're in right now. But currently, they can place a lien on the house, and this is where you're going to have to help me on the legal side. So when they do the concrete work or pour that foundation, they have the right to put a lien on that house. And then when it's sold, the title company is responsible for bringing all those liens forward and making sure they're paid at the time of sale, correct?
Yes. So they actually, usually the title company, usually those liens have to be cleared before they can even sell it.
Right.
Somehow they have to be paid off.
And because the friends of mine, they didn't get paid for, they had liens and still didn't get paid for them. So even with the existing law, and I think this is just going to be additional fee for us to hire additional people and still get nothing out of it for our contractors. So I don't really see this as being the answer.
Yeah. If I could add to Chair Hovey and to Vice Chair Widener, we have looked at many different possible solutions. This is one. I think my gut's telling me that they all have some degree of
of, I wouldn't want to say risk, but they all have pluses and minuses. This one is somewhat interesting because it provides some money, and if we had some experience, we might be able to help some consumers at a relatively low cost, particularly if we had a fee of $10 or $20 for a contractor. What's even more attractive to the Construction Contractors Board in the past has been the concept of using civil penalties. Penalties that we impose on unlicensed contractors for the most part, penalties that we pay a lot of money to collect, and then we give to the general fund. Of course, that's a very tough policy issue because the general fund needs the money. But who better to give it to than consumers who have been innocently victimized by a contractor that has gone out of business and not paid its hardworking subs and suppliers. It seems like a reasonable place to get the money to pay those consumers. And should you choose, if this scenario is interesting to you, that might be a different funding mechanism that is more attractive to you.
Follow up, Mr. Chair? Have you checked with any of the insurance companies? Because this seems like a market that would be prime for them for handling this for the subcontractors and protecting them better than what government could do.
Well, Chair Halvey and Representative Widener, the insurance companies, of course, the bonding companies is where we really do this kind of work, and I think we might have a bonding company interested in testifying. Perhaps they could address that issue.
Thank you. And I think from my perspective, I think this bill is aimed at really not protecting the contractor. It's aimed at protecting the consumer. The contractors are generally protected through the lien process. And, you know, last session in our committee, we talked about changing that law so that the consumers were protected but not the subcontractors. And, of course, the industry was not very supportive of that, and that concept failed in this committee with the help of my colleagues speaking out on that. I was speaking to Representative Gilliam and Representative Riley and myself, actually. We didn't really want to leave the subcontractors out in the dark either, but certainly having the consumer out there, you know, being the last one and being the one that's not protected is not really a good scenario, and I recognize this no proposal to fix this problem will be 100%, but certainly I think this concept, whatever funding mechanism we decide to work, will provide a substantial protection for consumers out there. Maybe not all of them, but quite a few. And so that's kind of my take on it, committee, since I just wanted to let you know that, because we did deal with this as it was one of the recommendations from the the Construction Contractors Task Force that was put into place a few years back anyway. And so we dealt with this last session and never resolved this issue. So we came back with this attempt to try to resolve it the best we thought we could. So that's kind of where we're at. Representative Wingard.
Mr. Chair, I just want to make sure I understood the history that you just gave. You're saying that last session there was consideration given to removing this lien ability so that subcontractors would then be in a relationship with a contractor where they would ask for the money up front. They would ask to be prepaid before they did work. But that was rejected by the committee, and that is why we are on the solution we're on now?
Yes.
Wish I'd been with you last time.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for pointing out those great moments when we agree. Craig, let's go back for a second, because I was educated in this committee about this twice pay issue, and I am concerned about it. But let's talk about the risk again. In round numbers, what are we talking about? How many folks lose their homes in Oregon over this?
Yeah.
One thing to have the lien, but how many actually lose it?
Chair Halvey and Representative Gilliam,
I can honestly tell you I have not heard of a single consumer who has lost their home. I can tell you that I have a lot of anecdotal evidence about consumers that have been frightened and paid twice. I can tell you that on some statistics I have put in the package here, and if you'll look at page number 14, that is a chart that shows the different claims just filed with CCB, and I don't think we get them all. So these are just the ones, the consumers that have chosen to file with this agency. And a portion of the pay twice we call those lien claims. And that's on line item number 602. I'm going to have to get glasses. And you can see that they're nickel and dimes. They added up to about 27 this last fiscal year. That was 1% of our total complaints. In addition to that, there are some of those lien complaints that are buried in with the larger item, which is known as owner complaints, of which there were some 14 to 1500 during the last fiscal year that we cannot decipher.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
That's helpful, and I don't discount at all. We had some folks come in and testify the difficulty that just going through it, let alone actually having to pay twice. So the injustice is noted. But I want to have a context for how serious this is. And again, it doesn't mean that we don't want to take another stab at it. But let me ask you this. In this, I don't know what you're facing budget-wise. I haven't seen the plans for your budget. But how do you afford dash one, that method? And secondly, how can the contractors, same thing, how can they afford dash twos in the context of where we are in this economy?
Yeah, good. Great questions, Chair Holvey and Representative Gilliam. First, the Construction Contractors Board is at risk, like many agencies, of being downsized to the portion to the extent that it'll be very difficult for us to enforce the regulations that we have imposed over the last 35 years. And a lot of those we imposed as a result of the Task Force on Construction Claims. If those aren't imposed, in my humble estimation, we're going to have a certain amount of chaos in the construction industry. And I'm serious about that, because we have a significant regulatory burden now. And those of us who choose to abide by the law are going to be, you've heard this before, but they're going to be at significant economic risk of not being able to have a competitive bid to those who aren't. So if you don't fund that enforcement action, it's going to be a problem. And when I was contracting, I'll be honest with you, I wasn't a big fan of regulation. I may not be today. But I can tell you this, whatever you impose, you've got to enforce it. If you don't enforce it, it's chaotic. And it's destructive for the market. And we can't allow that to happen. So I can't implore more seriously your consideration of the CCB budget, which is currently before your Ways and Means Committee. With that said, this is relatively small, you know, but it has the same kind of problem. When I'm trying to sell a job, particularly a roofing job, and I think you've heard this speech before, and my consumer can either put on a new roof where I can employ folks and make a profit, or they can use that money in a way that they're not put at risk. The consumer confidence is the issue here. And so removing the pay twice fear is important. Now, with that said, again, I'm going to pop back. Most consumers don't even know they're at risk. But this word spreads. And so stopping that risk could help the economy if it doesn't cost you much. And if it's only costing a contractor, you know, a couple of lattes, it may be worth a $5,000 roofing project, which we've got about $1,000 worth of profit in. So to me, it's properly leveraged cost. And of course, the dash ones are civil penalties. And that money we're talking about would come from the general fund. And of course, you've got better ways to spend it, I got to believe. But I'd rather you spend it on CCB.
Sure. One last follow-up, Mr.
Follow-up.
Chair. I always appreciate the fact that you've been in their shoes and that you're in the position you are. So I appreciate that very much. I don't know what the solution is. Before I ask you my question, I will say I get a lot of latte requests in a lot of committees. And we still, and this is no fault of yours, we still aren't to the point where we're making the large fiscal decisions. So for me to say this is a good one and we ought to bump you another $40 or $20 or whatever we end up, but I still, this is to my contractors in my district, I still don't know how bad the news is going to be at the end, is a real tough one for me. But last question. You answered Representative Riley's question, I think, on how quickly we could build this account up based on dash ones.
Two.
Same question for dash ones.
Yeah. Chair Holvey and Representative Gilliam, of course, we do collect those monies once a year. And so we would have some money after the first year, but not, we wouldn't have the maximum amount until after two.
Okay. Thank you, Craig. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And Craig, that's also relative to what amount we put into the bill. I mean, if we wanted to build it up faster, we could obviously increase the amounts in either the dash one or dash twos.
That's correct.
Thank you. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Craig, my concerns are fairly much the same as Representative Gilliam's, you know that. For me, I'm looking at this, it seems like it should be happening at the title end of things, either with title insurance when you're getting ready to buy the home to know you're protected going into it, and that's why I'm curious if you went that direction. And yeah, when you start talking about enforcement, I'm just wondering, matter of fact, I could probably be fairly safe to say, and you will know on this, that immigration has probably been a big problem with the problems we're having in the construction industries, is it not? As far as the bad illegal activity that goes on and everything?
Yeah. I think my response to that, Chair Holvey and Representative Widener, is that I wouldn't comment on the immigration issue other than to say that one of the loudest voices we get from our licensees is, what are you doing about workers on the job site? And we notice that there, my competition has folks who may not be in this country legally, and what are you doing? Our view is that our job is not focused on the nationality of the people working at the job site. However, we have a strong commitment to see to it that construction contractors are hiring individuals and paying them above board. If they're paying under the table, whether they're paying them as independent contractors or other workers, and they aren't covering them by workers' comp, and they're not paying the withholding, that's wrong. That's something we can work on, and we take that one. To be honest with you, we don't look at the language that's being spoken. We look at how the person is being paid.
Well, I mean, all of us can speak Canadian
follow
just
up.
Fine. So, yes.
Yeah, thank you for that. I think that this committee passed a bill out dealing with that very issue and had some fees in that to provide some enforcement money, if I recollect, in House Bill 2815 that I believe the CCB was testified on as well.
Correct.
So that is definitely a piece of this issue, and I think we're making, you know, at least an attempt at trying to address that specific issue and how it really is a slightly different issue in this. Certainly there's an effect of having unlicensed contractors on this issue, but this issue is pretty much about the consumer who ends up having to pay twice, and it's a very narrowly focused solution to that problem. It doesn't change the impact on suppliers or subcontractors. They still retain the current protections they have through the lien laws, which is what our committee could not address last session, because that didn't seem fair to the people that are out there working for a living. When they work, they expect to get paid. So I think this is a really good proposal. I do not want to work this bill today. However, I want to give a chance to talk to the bonding company and the home builders, and also to my co-chairs of the Ways and Means, to see which one of these methods, or maybe a hybrid of the two, would be more palatable in the Ways and Means process, because this bill will ultimately probably end up there. So that's the rest of my commentary, and I think I'm going to bring up some others. I appreciate your testimony and your work on continuing work on this issue. I've had some interest in this since last session, still trying to solve this issue, because I believe, like you, when this shows up in the Oregonian, it causes more damage to the industry than it's really worth. And I think it would be a great thing for the industry to try to solve this problem with one of these funding mechanisms, at least maybe not totally, but mostly. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you very much.
Next up, I have Brian Doherty, Scott Berry, and Don Miner.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Brian Doherty here testifying on behalf of Contractors Bonding and Insurance Company. They are a bonding insurance company headquartered in Seattle with a significant office in Portland as well. And they primarily insure and bond small, I call them small mom-and-pa contractors. They are not the big home builders, but they are a small group that do less than probably two or three homes a year. And I want to talk a little bit about this, and there's some questions asked that hopefully I can address, and hopefully I can come up with some thoughts. The small contractor, I think you heard Craig Smith testify today that I think his budget is being severely hit, and he's thinking about whether he needs to add more fees on contractors. Dash 1 or Dash 2 is the one that puts an additional $40 fee on the contractors. That is a concern to them. These things come from everywhere, and these folks aren't building much at all right now, and they have to pay that fee whether they build anything or not. I hear the purpose of this bill, and I understand. I remember when you folks were introduced to this time, several of you had that look on your face about somebody paying twice for the same thing. And I remember when I first heard it, I go, I don't get this myself. It's had a long history. We won't go into that so much. But I do think, if you're looking at that purpose, we should try and address this. And other states have tried. What I've sent around to you, my testimony, are two states, California and Arizona, that attempted to do recovery funds and found them to simply not stay solvent. And I think that's one of the problems with this. You have, I think Representative Wiener asked, why not have the private insurance do this? If an insurance company proposed that we were going to get you a fund that allow you to recover, but we'll pay you only once a year, and we don't know how much you're going to get until the end of the year after we see how many other claims come, and then we'll just do a pro rata payment, you'd have an uproar. I don't think, one, we could get it through the insurance division. I think we'd be thrown in jail if we did it in the first place. It simply isn't a viable way of doing something in the private insurance. This is not a private insurance. This is the state. But it is problematic, and if you look at those other funds, they simply were going empty all the time. And you create an expectation with these homeowners that they're going to get full payment. So let me talk about what I think is something that might be able to deal with this. What we have here is an education issue and a problem of having the homeowner getting out in front, paying too much to the general contractor without having assurances that the subs haven't been paid. One of the things you could do is say that a contractor can only get 10% upfront down payment. And if they want more, the contractor could buy what's called another bond. It's a bond that's called a pre-release of lien bond. So this would protect the homeowner in some fashion if the contractor wants to have more money up front. You could have the contractor certainly needs to get payments along the way. You could have something that would require that they show that they've paid their subcontractors before the next payment comes due. But this is what it is. You've gone out too far with the contractor. The contractor's gotten into trouble, and the homeowner's now got this lien that they never expected to come up for paying those. It is one of those things where I think we said here, if I recall the testimony, that it was out of 100,000 housing projects, they had 27 people that were dealing with this. Now, let's say it's even double that or 100 instead of 27. That's less than one, that's 0.1% of the projects being built that we're understanding had claims under a lien. 100,000 projects, I believe, is what I heard him testify to. I wrote down when he testified that. So in that year, 1,000 would be 1%. 100 would be 0.1% of the claims for the number of projects being built. This builds a $500,000 fund to handle that, and I'm just not sure that's the best way to do it. And I appreciate others have looked, and I really appreciate Chair Holvey's attempt to find an answer to this. It is difficult to understand when a homeowner would ever have to pay twice for a subcontractor, but I think these have not done well before, and there may be another way to work this, and I'd be happy to help if I can. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, members
Mr.
of the committee.
Chair, can I ask a question? I'm just sharing my... May I ask a quick question?
Sure.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. On the materials that we were handed, I'm sure you've got them too. It seems like there were 2,700 complaints in fiscal year 07-08. So
I don't have those materials, but I understood them to say that recorded with the CCB were 27 claims for a double lien, a double payment. We're at page 14. So maybe
we have somebody here who can correct me.
Turning to page 14.
And for the record, Craig Smith.
Yeah. Excuse me, Chair Holvey. For the record, Craig Smith. On page 14, line item 602, this is a one page of a many, many page report. It talks about the pay twice lien complaints at the CCB. And fiscal year ending June 30th, 2008, the total number of CCB complaints received was 27. That's 1% of the complaints that we received, and it's fair to say that is a fraction of the jobs in Oregon, a small fraction.
I see. Okay, so the number of 2,700 follow-up. Thank you. That's a total of all kinds of complaints, not just people who have paid twice. Is that correct, Craig?
Chair Holvey and Representative Tomei, that is correct.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And, Craig, before you go, as well, just to reiterate what you already said, but there's probably many other pay-twice lien situations that are not filed in that particular column under complaints.
Chair Holvey, that's correct. There would be many of those that are companions or portions of the owner complaints, of which there were 4,660 in fiscal year ending June 30th, 2008.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, and many that you may not even know about.
Chair Holvey and Representative Riley, that's correct.
Thank you.
May I be excused, sir?
Yes.
Good afternoon. For the record, Scott Berry, on behalf of the Oregon Home Builders Association. And I've done this before, but I'd just like to briefly point out at the beginning of the hearing on this bill that in terms of new construction, this issue was solved by requiring a title insurance, and that was a Representative Merkley bill that we spent quite a bit of time on him. But it requires a number of options. Five of them, I think, were available to the consumer and the contractor to figure out. But the reality is that a title insurance that was historically going to the banks anyway was an early issue title insurance was issued on any remodel over 50,000 and all new construction aside from custom homes. So in terms of the mass of the majority of homes that are sold out there, this is not an issue because there's title insurance to cover that period between the last subcontractor leaving the job. They have 75 days to perfect their lien. That title insurance covers that 75 days. So if something pops up, then the title insurance pays it, so the banks and the consumers are not left with it. So let's just clarify that. And then I would offer the fact that there is that other option of a solution, and that is that if the consumer pays the contractor on those jobs under $50,000, they are then off the hook, and it becomes a business-to-business relationship, much like if I was down in the restaurant and I ordered a sandwich, and I ate my sandwich. The restaurant shuts down. The person who provided the bacon for my bacon lettuce tomato sandwich doesn't come after me to pay for that bacon. I mean, so I'm just trying to give you a scenario under the construction industry. Once that consumer pays for those under $50,000 on the remodel, then they would be off the hook. Having said that, and realizing we may not be going down that road today, we are supportive of these two options, of the dash ones, where we take the civil penalty money that's been levied against contractors who have had problems and been fined, and take that and send the folks who are either going around the law or who have been fined by the contractor's board for violations, and send that money to the consumer instead of asking the contractors who are doing it by the book to pay an additional fee to support the folks who are doing it wrong or to cover the debt of the folks who are doing it wrong. And then finally, I would just kind of back up one other thing that was mentioned by the Construction Contractors Board folks. This is an additional $40 fee. It's not a massive fee, but we're really having trouble right now getting the construction, with construction industry support, getting money for the Construction Contractors Board just to do the enforcement and the continuing mandatory continuing education and even contractor-to-contractor dispute resolution stuff through. All very, very important, and I just would hate to see that get lost in this discussion of an additional $40. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Don Miner, here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association. I believe we're on record as supporting a fee increase for the Construction Contractors Board, but that was to maintain their current services. If there's to be a recovery fund, I think we agree with the home builders that would like to see that money come out of the civil penalty side. And it seems like there's a certain poetic justice of letting wrongdoers pay for the defaults of other wrongdoers. But I've been doing this a lot of years, and the pay twice thing has been here forever. I think my 30th year. And the first time I understood how that worked, I was surprised. And I don't think there's probably a handful of ordinary consumers that get that, that would understand the jeopardy they're in. It just doesn't seem sensible to me that a supplier or equipment provider extends credit to a contractor. He trusts that contractor, but he's looking to a homeowner for repayment. The homeowner had no involvement in that. It just seems so unfair, and it seems to me that that's the root of the problem. In creating a recovery fund, it really just kind of papers over a problem that ought to be addressed. Now, I think Jessica Adamson last time, her words were the water's deep, filled with alligators, but it's probably worth wading into that subject. It's just the root of a lot of problems. And with that, I'll conclude my remarks.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony today.
Thank you.
May I add a couple comments?
Did I miss you?
No, I didn't sign on the list.
Oh, well, certainly.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Gaffori. I represent the Oregon Remodelers Association. I appreciate the courtesy. I hadn't had a chance to look at these dice, too, until just this minute. And after I read them, I thought I should make a couple of comments. First, I want to say that there's another fee that you haven't heard about because it's coming through another committee, and that's having to do with lead-based paint. Contractor is going to have to pay another fee for lead-based paint, plus they're going to have someone take 8 hours of classes, which is a big chunk of money taking someone off the job. I think it's important. Lead-based paint is a terrible risk for children in our state. But how much can we continue to pile on the individual contractors? especially at a time when contracting business is down. The experience, you heard folks from CCB say we should do a little bit of this and take some experience. What the experience in other states is once you open up a game like this, you can find out it doesn't raise as much money as you thought, and the claims are much bigger than you thought, and then you go back and hit up the contractor for more money and more money. I think that the Dash 2s are an invitation to a bigger and bigger hit on the contractor down the line. I think that's experience in other states, and I don't see why Oregon would be any different. Frankly, Mr. Chair, my committee would the Oregon Remodel Association folks would rather see elimination totally of the pay twice people, so that the situation, if you don't, if the contractor doesn't pay his subs are out of luck. We'd rather play that game. I used to work for a trucking company, Mr. Chair, before I came back into law.
That's different from your testimony last session.
I don't believe it was. Did I oppose it last session?
Yeah.
Maybe different people on my legislative committee, Mr. Chair. It's funny how that happens. I used to work for a trucking company, and one of my jobs for the trucking company was to call up when someone would order a load, call up the bank, and find out, did that shipper have money in the bank? And if they didn't have a certain amount of money in the bank, we didn't carry their load. And the people that are in the subcontracting business are big people. They're business folks, and they can, I think, do their own thing. Where, you know, we do have a lot of attempted opportunities to educate the consumers. We give them all kinds of warning notices, but it's complicated and it's difficult. And I don't blame consumers for not being in position to follow through. But I think that for the business people involved in this game, I think it's a different situation.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's good to see you, Stephen.
Thank you.
Stephen, I think I'm hearing conflicting things. I'm hearing on one hand there were only 27 complaints of people paying twice last year, and then on the other hand I'm hearing that there are going to be so many complaints that the fund won't be enough to pay them all.
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, there are two things. First of all, complaints come out of the woodwork when there's money available.
Mm-hmm.
I promise you that. And secondly, if you heard the testimony, this was only a small percentage. That 27 is a number, a percentage of the total claims where there are paid twice, is because when some of those claims are claims listed under some other category, and the pay twice also occurred along with shoddy workmanship or some other concern. There is no number right now. CCB does not have a number of how many pay twice situations there were in the state of Oregon. We have no idea. And on top of that, as I say, you can be sure that once somebody finds out there's money available, there will be a lot more people say, that happened to me as well. I just didn't follow. I didn't tell anybody because I didn't think there was anything anybody could do about it.
Follow it. So, Stephen, it seems like you're saying that there would be lots. This happens a lot. But right now, people don't come forward because there's no way that they can get any satisfaction from that. Is that what I'm hearing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, what I'm saying is nobody knows. That 27 may be the exact number. It may be 57, it may be 157, it may be 500. I have no idea. No, nobody can put a number on that because there's nobody checking that out.
Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you for your testimony. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2366 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2962. Victoria, give us a brief description of House Bill 2962.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2962 requires the Department of Consumer and Business Services to adopt rules requiring contractors to submit complete list of contractors and subcontractors to obtain certificate of occupancy for new residential structures and zero lot line dwellings. Requires Construction Contractors Board to include certificate of occupancy obligations in its notice and contractors to provide a list of subcontractors to property owners. Makes violation subject to civil penalty not to exceed $5,000.
Thank you. And if I could get Mark Long to come up and talk to us a little bit about this bill. Colleagues, this is also a topic that came from the Construction Claims Task Force. discussions last session, and it was aimed at trying to provide homeowners with some accountability for making sure that people that were working on their homes were licensed, bonded, insured, and that they knew who was actually doing the work on their projects, because it did cause some problems from time to time with homeowners having to pay for various things, whether it be workers' comp insurance on a an accident or some other issue. So, Mr. Long.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Mark Long, Administrator of State Building Codes. As the Chair indicated, coming out of the 2005 session, the bill passed to create a construction claims defect task force, which we administered through the interim between 05 and then 07, came forward to the legislature with a series of recommendations. I spent quite a bit of time in this committee last session talking about the various recommendations from that task force, and this committee took action on a variety of them. One of the items that was recommended in the task force report, it's an 80-some page document that we distributed for the last legislative session, contained a requirement to, one, make sure that for residential construction there was a certificate of occupancy. That's a document that basically has been used in commercial construction for some time, and it basically states that the home is safe for occupancy. And two, to align the certificate of occupancy up with various administrative things that the task force had recommended. At that time, they had recommended some additional standards for folks who worked on siding and roofing and things like that, and to line this CBO up with those provisions, and then also to get the listing of those names. What you did pass last session was actually the language that, if you look at 2962, the permissive language that's unbolded, if you will, in Section 1, was a result of, and forgive me, Chair, I forget the bill number from last session, but anyway, that allowed my agency to go off and adopt rules to, A, require a C of O, and B, come up with some procedures. And we've done that for the residential structures that went into place April 1st. The challenge that we had was on the enforcement piece, which this bill covers, and then a robust list of contractors. So this bill would require all contractors who work on a project to have those names provided, and then prevent a building department from issuing that C of O until they had that list, and then, of course, the enforcement provisions. A couple things I've shared with the Chair as drafted. I'd like the committee to consider that a contractor failing to provide subcontractor names may not be one of the reasons you want to prevent occupancy of a home for a homeowner who's in between selling homes and wanting to get into their house. So you may want to allow for a temporary C of O, and this seems to prevent that action from what I can tell, Mr. Chair. And then you may want to clarify exactly the contractors you do want listed, because this is very broad and you could get in a situation where every contractor, and I'm not sure if that was the intent of the task force. I think it was really more at your framing and roofing and kind of main components of the house versus who might have done a small area of carpeting in a home, that type of thing. So that would be my comments, and I'd be happy to take any questions that you have, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I think, Mr. Long, when we originally talked about this bill, it was aimed at the contractors that did the work that was required to have an inspection on them.
Yeah.
Instead of all of the contractors. But certainly, you know, problems arise, you know, no matter what kind of contractor you have. Sometimes it may be the carpet installer who didn't have workers' comp on the job that ends up the homeowner gets stuck with. So, you know, that it could be a scenario like that. So I think that your suggestions are good on this. I certainly am wanting to work with this. I, you know, on the last bill, you know, we have a little bit of work left to do. I know we heard that bill first in February, so now I'm getting input on the bill a couple months later. So this one, however, we haven't had a public hearing on before, and it's a very short time frame to try to get something done on this one. Not sure if we'll get there, but I do want to have a conversation on seeing whether we can address something on this issue. So I appreciate your input on it. Questions from the committee? Thank you, and I appreciate your testimony. Scott Berry, wanted to testify?
For the record, Scott Berry, representing the Oregon Home Builders Association. Mr. Chair, I'd hate to let a bill relating to contractors get by without having the chance to testify. Very briefly, I think our issues with this, and I've mentioned them before, revolve around the scenario where the general contractor gives the list of the subcontractors to the homeowner. The homeowner then has a problem with their roof. The roof is leaking, causing some damage in the rest of the house. The roofing contractor gets called because that's the person that the homeowner has, and comes out and fixes the roof. Unfortunately, there's still problems with potentially the sheetrock, potentially the insulation that may not be visible, and our concern is making sure that the person that gets contacted is the general contractor. In the end, that is the person who is liable for the damage caused by any of the subcontractors. And that general contractor then has the ability to bring in those subcontractors if they were deemed responsible, such as the roofing contractor. But they may never get that phone call, and that's the concern we have. Currently, the Construction Contractors Board has the ability to require any general contractor to supply the list of subcontractors who worked on that job, and that's specifically initially for the reasons you mentioned, dealing with workers' compensation insurance. I think our solution would involve allowing the consumer to do the same thing that they can today, and that is getting a hold of the list of subcontractors that work on the job. But in doing so, that requires the Construction Contractors Board to get a hold of the general to ask for the list of subcontractors, which that general is required to do under civil penalty authority by the Contractors Board. And the thing that does for us is that alerts the general contractor that at a certain address, which means they know the address and they know the home, there could be a problem on that home, and that they should indeed as well get a hold of that homeowner and attempt to address that issue. Because the last thing we want to see is the scenario where that roof leaks, the roofing contractor comes out, fixes the roof, and we never find out. So I think it's in place in many ways. It's not used, but I think it is in place that the and maybe it takes a tweaking of the form that currently exists. But I think what makes sense is still to allow that consumer to go through the Construction Contractors Board, who then contacts the general contractor and requires that information be given. That information is required to be given, again, under civil penalty authority, and then the general contractor is alerted there could be a problem on the job site or on the job site from a year or so ago. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate the suggestion. So you're basically saying that that if a contract between the construction contractor and the homeowners, maybe should specify that the homeowner can get this list through the CCB?
Chair Holby, that could be one of the solutions. I'm not sure that the homeowners are always aware of their ability to get that list, and you know, providing something like that through contract. I know we've required things in Oregon contract that contractors provide to the consumer before, and so that may be the better solution. That gets everybody involved. Everyone understands going in what the process is, and the general doesn't get caught not knowing that there was a problem on a house they built.
Thank you. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is really not a question for you, but you're there, so the consumer actually mostly doesn't even know there's a CCB. I think that's accurate. I know that, you know, they maybe know that there's a general contractor. They maybe know that there are subs, but mostly homeowners don't even know how their house got built, frankly. They don't know that there is a general contractor. They don't know that there's a CCB. Am I way off base there?
Chair Holby, Representative Riley, I'm not sure how far off base you are. I would tend to agree that that consumers don't always do as much homework as they should before they purchase what may be the most expensive thing they purchase during their lifetime. But I do know that we've talked with the Construction Contractors Board about partnering with even fee increases, although it's certainly not something we're going to try to go after this session, to do more consumer notification to try to get that word out there. They do show up at the trade shows where the home and garden shows and that sort of thing and pass out information. There are requirements in information that we give the consumer, every single one of them, that talks about checking with your checking with the Construction Contractors Board and looking up their license. It's not done as much as it needs to be.
Right.
Certainly that's the answer.
Can you comment? I know the Building Codes Division, as Mr. Long was testifying to, currently requires that information of some contractors, just not all. If I understood his testimony correctly, right now to get a certificate of occupancy, they have to list the plumbing contractor, I believe, and the electrical contractor, and a few others. So they already do this reporting for the C of O. Isn't that correct?
Generally, I believe that's correct for electrical, mechanical, and plumbing. In terms of whether or not the consumer is getting that information, they get information from the contractor required by law, both at bid and at contract. So, you know, I think that information is getting to them. Whether they're using it or not is something you can't always force.
Mm-hmm. But that process is in place for at least those three subcontractor types.
Charlie, I believe that's accurate.
Thank you. I was wondering if I could get Representative Gilliam a question.
Just a quick comment, Mr. Chair. Thank you. To Representative Riley's point, I regret that he's right. Most folks don't know about CC. I always do it wrong. Craig's group. But most folks, most folks, with the exception of maybe the Emerald Empire, don't know who their state representative is either.
Deliberately.
It's true.
I don't know how to comment on that. But,
except in my district.
Certainly, I think most construction jobs are required to have a contract, you know, if they're over $2,000, and I believe that somewhere on there is a reference to the Construction Contractors Board. So, you know, for a consumer not to know that one exists, I think they would have to not be able to read, or they're not reading their contract themselves.
I think it's
reading
the latter.
The contract.
So
it's definitely the latter.
But I was wondering if I could get Craig Smith back up here for a moment.
Chair Holvey, Craig Smith, Contractors Board.
Thank you. I'm intrigued by Mr. Berry's suggestion of having some sort of. We have a number of notices and contracts that are required for the consumer who's hiring a contractor. And I guess how do you see the process if a homeowner were to say to the CCB, I want a list of the contractors that are working on my home, would the CCB be able to get that to them in a timely manner?
Chair Holvey and members of the committee, currently the current law does require that contractors keep a list of all subcontractors that they work on the job, and it allows the Contractors Board to demand to see that list. I believe it's within 48 hours. And we use that authority particularly when we're trying to determine the legality of people working on the job site, particularly whether the subs are properly licensed or not. We use it a lot. Sometimes contractors do not turn that in, and we give civil penalties in those situations. I can envision a situation where, you know, as you talk about it, it's stimulating to me because I can imagine a web-based portal where homeowners could go and request this information. We could then send it to a contractor. Contractor could send us the material. We might be able to send it then back electronically. Now, how fast we might be able to do that, I don't know. But you know, it is kind of interesting to think about using a web-based approach to achieve that goal.
And I guess so my question right now is if a homeowner requested that of the CCB, is there statutes or rules in place that allows or directs the CCB to get that information to the consumer?
Chair Holvey, the answer to that question would be no. It's as I understand it, that law is for CCB. We've only used it for enforcement purposes. I do not believe we've ever done requested that list because a homeowner has asked for it. But we could.
Yeah.
If the law so allowed you to do that.
Thank you. Representative Riley.
And so you're saying that you can't do it now?
Chair Holvey and Representative Riley, I'd want to research that. I haven't thought that one all the way through and read the law and looked at it. If a homeowner asks for it, we have the authority to demand it. The law isn't precise as to why we can demand it, so I'd have to see if we have the statutory authority to demand it without further changing the law. But certainly, if you specifically said in some form of law change that we want the CCB to do this, obviously we could.
Thank you. And I'm sure there'd probably be a fiscal of that, too. But anyway.
just a quick comment, and in fairness to Craig Smith, director of the Construction Contractors Board, we just sort of discussed through this concept within the last day. So, but we were looking for a solution to try to get to the root of the problem without creating a new system that may cause problems. And, you know, I'm not so sure they can't do it today through administrative rule change, but that's certainly something we're happy to work on with them, because I think that is the better solution to the problem. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate your input. Not seeing any other questions today, so appreciate you coming forward and appreciate your testimony. So with that, committee, I'm going to close the... Bill Cross. Oh, I almost closed it. Bill Cross has signed up to speak on House Bill 2962.
Probably wish I did close it.
I caught that.
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Bill Cross. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Building Officials Association, and I did want to bring up a couple of the concerns that Mark Long has already raised, so I won't really get into it other than to suggest that we would have concerns about withholding the certificate of occupancy. I think Mr. Berry's suggestion sounds like a sound one, because it would, I think, perhaps give a better, more direct information to the homeowner, because we only keep records for 2 years, and after that certificate is issued, we would retain that information for 2 years, then it would be gone, and if the owner had not requested it, frankly, it would be gone. So I like the idea that was raised earlier, and we're happy to try and work with the committee on resolving this.
Thank you. Appreciate any questions for Mr. Cross. Not seeing any. With that, I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 2962 committee. And
the committee, we have a meeting tomorrow evening.
We will carry over House Bill 2366. And with that, I'm going. Anything else?
We're meeting tomorrow evening at 5:30.
We are meeting tomorrow evening at 5:30.
Please ask them to sit till we're done.
I don't know if everybody got that. So with that, I'm going to close the House Committee on Consumer Protection.